Okay, alle, op og stå.
Må jeg lige give dig nogle instruktioner for lige kort?
Ja, jeg skal jo ikke ud på WC med den.
Nej.
Nej.
Det skal du være med. Men hvis du lige trykker en gang der, og så kommer sådan en rød, sådan en sort plakat.
En rød eller den sort?
Så går den i gang.
Okay.
Må jeg lige spørge, hvor skulle vi gøre det derinde?
Når vi går i gang, det er første slutningen, så kommer du herop.
Okay,
og Maja skal stå op.
Så tager jeg bare en stol op.
Ja. Ja. Jeg kan lige vise dig, når man trykker her en gang, så kommer sådan en sort.
Jeg kan overhovedet ikke se den sorte plads. Nej, ikke mine briller.
Nå, okay.
Jeg er gammel af.
Du sætter den, så bare sæt den i gang.
Der så kommer vi i gang.
Ja, ja.
Okay. Så, nej, det kan ikke blive at være her. Det gør jeg altså ikke.
Skal jeg ikke sætte den på der, ja.
Kan du ikke hjælpe mig, Tom? Jeg tror, du stoler på dig, at du ikke gør låset forkert. Okay, nu tog han slet ikke plads af det der i går. Okay, okay.
No English.
English, yes. So, this might be a little lengthy. Okay, I have taken several things and put them together. And I really mean it when I say that if I am too talking to myself, knowing it and so forth, and I'm not clear enough, please stop me. Also, if there's some in my English, except for Joseph, if there's something in English you don't understand, stop me. But if and if there's something where you have a question and you don't understand, and I think that it comes later, I'll tell you it comes later. But really, don't hold back, because if you just sit there and fall asleep and don't get it, I mean, the idea is I'm going to try to give you a certain idea today about Joan of Arc. And the reason, oh no, not, not before,
Wait
a minute.
Okay.
No. What are you doing?
Jeg forsøger
ligesom
at se noget.
Okay. Så jeg venter lidt nu.
Okay. Nej, men, jamen, det er nemmere at lige tage den her fra. Det er klart, sæt det op.
Skal jeg være i gang? Okay. Men jeg vil have det rigtige billede, ikke bare den der med, at de har det ved siden af. Jeg vil have det rigtige billede på. Okay.
Ja, så det skal være fuldskærm.
Fuldskærm.
Jamen, men det vil du ikke have i går.
Jeg vil gerne have fuldskærm.
Ja, sæt det klar.
Men når jeg er parat. Jeg troede, du var en rigtig nerd, Tom.
Jamen, jeg kan bare ikke se noget.
I'm going to talk about a unique individual today, Joan of Arc, and all of you have heard about Joan of Arc, I assume. And the reason originally that, Friedrich Schiller has written a drama of Joan of Arc. We can discuss that later if you wish. And she has had many, people have made movies of her. Most of it is disgusting, romantic stuff. The actual reason I wanted to look at the historical Joan of Arc is that LaRouche a number of times have said that because of her actions in her short life, that the first nation state was formed in the world. And that was in France in 1461. Well, she died in 1429. So I wanted to figure out how could LaRouche say that? How did that function? So that is what I'm going to do today. But she's also in that work that she's doing, making the basis for creating the first nation state. And when we come to the end and you have not figured that out, you ask me questions so that I can explain it, so that you don't leave without understanding it. Because then I've not done the job good enough, and I'll just have to, there's certain things I might have forgotten and so on. So if you don't understand when I'm finished how she create, how she was crucial in creating the first nation state, then ask me. Also, she is just a wonderful person, young person, but a wonderful person in history of acting in a sublime manner for mankind. We have had a number in history, and she is very unique. So, and therefore also a inspiration for us today. Like Lincoln can be an inspiration, like Martin Luther King can be an inspiration, and many others. So Joan of Arc, very much also because she was so young, is a wonderful inspiration what the actions of an individual can mean for history and inspire other people around her to act. So let's start after her life. Go. In 14 in 1450 Charles VII sends out a proclamation to all of France, and I'll just read up the very end of the proclamation starting here where he says yes, he is the King of France. Thanks for the question. We authorize, command, and expressly enjoin that you inquire into and inform yourself diligently on that which is said about it, and that the information gathered by you on this matter bring it closed and sealed before us and people of our council. That is, in the beginning he talks about in this proclamation that this Maid of Orléans has been wrongly persecuted in a trial and killed in a horrible way, and now he wants to have an investigation. So the King of France in 1450 sends this proclamation out for a investigation into the death of Joan of Arc. Next. Okay. So here's one of, you've probably seen, all of you have seen statues of her, pictures of her. I like one of these where she's a real fighter. And she's really, she's, one of the key things that she's doing is that, what I said before, that she was an exceptional individual who really acted in a sublime manner, and I hope I'll show you that later. But one of the ways in which it functioned too was that she put very sharply, and I hope you will see that, the political and cultural battle between, on the one hand, a Renaissance person, a real truly human being, and that of the oligarchy. And think about a little bit what we talked about the oligarchy last night. And through her just sticking to her mission, not giving up, even if it looked really horrific, she inspired people around her, including many older people, to fight. She recruited thousands of soldiers that volunteered to join the army. And through this one person's actions, Europe was transformed. So what she's up against in Europe at that time, and it's not the same as today, but you have some certain similar points concerning what we are up against today in the world, concerning Joseph kept saying last night, this is not easy, and so on. She's in the church in Europe. There are some really nasty pigs that are working with the oligarchy. So she's up against those. Like, you have heard about the Inquisition in Spain and so forth. These kind of preachers she was up against in the church. She was up against the oligarchy in France and the oligarchy in England. So there was many different, and they were all collaborating, that the oligarchy in France, the oligarchy in England, and the people in the church collaborating with them. That is what she was up against. And she, in other words, she was up against the spiritual wickedness in high places. And I'm going to show you now, for the sake of when you want to study this more and understand also more where Joan of Arc comes from, because she's a very Christian person, and you can understand her although you might not be Christian. It's the same way you can understand Cusa without being Christian. You will also, through having this quote in your mind, understand better if you read Schiller's Joan of Arc. Because if you study Joan of Arc, you'll see that she goes, the real historical Joan of Arc, she goes out of her way to get a special sword, and she has to have a special shield and a helmet and her armor. Everything has to be special, specially designed and so on. And that's also what you have in Schiller's drama, that is very special helmet, a special sword, a special shield. Well, there's an idea behind it, and the idea comes from the Bible. And Joan of Arc was very Christian, and at Schiller's time too, everybody knew the Bible. And so what you have in Paul's letters to the Ephesians, he says, this is a very political statement, put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, the oligarchy, the syndicalists, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places, like Prince Philip, spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, wherein ye shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. And take the helmet of salvation, and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. So if you don't take it literally, take it as an image of what you have to do when you have to go out in the street and organize people that walk like Pustreuil and they are just in a total fantasy land, or people that are nasty and call you bad things or whatever. You have to shield yourself with righteousness, with truth, using the sword of the Spirit. So it is an image of how you have to prepare yourself when you're going to fight. What is the setting at the time that she lived? What's the question?
I just want to go into righteousness.
Righteousness? Okay. So, what is the setting where Joan of Arc lives? Because that's also all the time when you have a person, you have to figure out what is the historical person when that person lives. And she lives in the high point of the Hundred Years' War, which started 13-something, I have it down here, 1337, and lasted for 120 years. And at the point when she lives, that was the high point of the Hundred Years' War. And most of that war was taking place in the country of France. That is, just think about the war today in Iraq. It's different weapons being used and so forth. But just think about if you are a child and a young person in Iraq, how that shaped the way you are thinking. So this is the kind of condition she was growing up in. You had a very big schism in the church. The church had been split up, and it was really problematic. We can discuss that a little bit later if necessary. And then you had the Charles the VI, that is Charles the VII's father, and his wife Isabel, or Isabeau, I think her name was. They were pretty corrupt. And Isabeau said, now it's where you can lose me, or I can lose you. Isabeau said that Charles the VII was not the legitimate heir to the throne, because he was not her son. And there was this whole, that is, she had gotten pregnant with another man, right? That is the Queen of France coming out saying that. She helped the King of England to become King of France, which I'm coming to in a second. But I'm saying all this because there is this myth in France at that time, which all the villages and so forth they're talking about, that France was lost by a woman, a bad woman, and France is going to be won back by a virgin. And this is something that people believe and talk about out in the villages. You have to see that France is occupied, wars, killing, and so forth. So you have this legend going around that France was lost by a bad woman, and France is going to be rebuilt again by a virgin. So let's take the next. I'm going to show you this a couple of times. Now I just want to give you a short outline. Okay, so she is born in 1412, and I want to point out what I put in the parentheses there, namely Cusa, Nicholas Cusanus, Cusa. He was born just 11 years earlier, and I'll say already now that Cusa was very inspired and admired Joan of Arc a lot, and their roads in life would either directly or indirectly touch each other. So I just want to point this out already now. And so you have like her childhood before she becomes into the battle, and then you have a very short time from the end of 28 to the beginning of 30, that is 1 year and a few months, 1.5 years, where she is in a battle until she gets jailed. And then she has the actually trial, and she gets burned alive, and then you have the rehabilitation. I'm going to come back to this timeline, but just so she has her childhood, the time of all the battles and so forth that she's in, and then the persecution of her. So let's take the next one. This is where she grew up, in the house. This still stands. And for those days in 1412, this was not a poor house. This was good farmers. They were not poor farmers. They were good French farmers, very religious. That is, they would go to communion whenever you are going to do that as a Catholic. They would pray, all the different things you have to do as a Catholic, and so on. And near her house there was a special tree where the kids like to go and so forth and play. And when she's 13 years old, she begins to get some visions. She begins to hear some voices. And they say that she has to conduct herself very well, that she has a very special mission. And the voices are coming back 2 to 3 times a week. And more gets it developed that her mission in life is to save France. And then it becomes specific that what she's going to do is to free Orléans, the city of Orléans, and I'll show you a map of that. And she's going to get the King of France crowned. I want to say already here, because we had a discussion about that in the U.S. in connection with her voices, where one of the youth said, look, this thing with the voices. And the funny thing is they asked Phil, I had talked about it, and they asked Phil, because he's more reasonable than I am. So... And Phil answered, well, have you never heard any voices? Have you ever never had anybody talk to you in your head? But most of the time it's bad voices pulling you down. And sometimes there's a little voice coming telling you, no, you should actually be doing this and this. So you can take it however you want to do it. But I just wanted to intersperse that. She grows up in, and think about again how she grows up in this devastated France. It is a place, it's called Domremy, where Cusa and Augustinians and others, and I'll talk about this actually right after this, are very, very active in organizing. And she has this very religious upbringing. So she hears these voices. And next, and that is, can people see this over here? Okay, yeah, that's much better. So you had something at that time called the Brethren of Common Life, or the Brotherhood of the Common Life Schools. And this was a order which very much emphasized education of everybody, including poor people, orphans, whatever. That is the very, very important in order to participate in God, in order to make use of yourself, people needed an education. And they worked very closely with the Augustinian monk orders. And where you could see where you have the triangles, that's where you have their actually houses and schools. And then when you have the round spots, that's where you have monasteries and so forth, which are influenced by them. And then right here, this is where Joan of Arc grows up, right here. And we know that Cusa worked with this order, and we know that he often came through where Joan of Arc lived. But also we know that the entire family of Joan of Arc worked very closely with the Augustinian order. And let's take the next. Yeah, the timeline again, because I want to go through a little bit more now. I've ordered in that way to hope to give it as clear as I can so it doesn't get too confused. In back to what is the times that she's living in. In 1415, you have the French are in a big battle where it is so, their loss is so big that the French have 7,000 people killed and the British 500. And then in 1418, I say that the English enter Paris, this the key city of France. And what you have is that the president of the, can we take the next? I have to do that actually. The president of the University of Paris, his name is Gerson. And I wrote his name up there because he's an important person that you don't hear so much about. He was the president of the University of Paris. He also worked very closely with the Brethren of Common Life. And they were officially, the Brethren of Common Life, they were officially charged with heresy, Quaderie heresy, because only nuns and monks should learn anything so they could get close to God. Common man should not. And Gerson argued that in order for Carpax Dei to participate in God, to do what you were born to be doing, people should learn to read and write and so forth. So he's a big defender of the Brethren of Common Life. But there in 1418, again in the same period, you have that they are being accused of being heretic, and you have a court case where Gerson is defending the Brotherhood of Common Life. Also, this man, he writes the, listen up, he writes the education program for Louis the 11th, who long time later should be the founder of the first modern nation state. So this guy writes the education program for the future king. Okay, so let's get a next one. Yeah, just so you can get a little sense of the lay of the land. You can see France was somewhat bigger at that time. So here you have up here where Joan of Arc lives, Domremy. This little enclave, there's another little enclave there. And then you have all the stuff with the stripes is controlled by the English. And all the ones with the dots are controlled by the Burgundians.
What is the enclave?
This is where she grew enclave. This is like a little place which is not occupied. This is where she grows up. But of course, there's refugees. You know, when you have war, there's refugees. There's all these news of heads. There's all these news on the wars, the people dying, and all this kind of stuff. So this is the English occupation. And this is the occupation of the Burgundians. And see, the Burgundians are French. And typical oligarchical policy, when you want to control a country, then you have the French helping the British control the country. So you have the Burgundians, they are French, but they are working, they're in bed with the British in occupying France. Okay, and they are totally in it in getting the King of England crowned to become the King of France, and that's the situation we have when we look at this in 1429. The King of France is British. It's Henry V, and he's King of France. Okay, and you can see this huge part of France being occupied, and this is the only thing that is not occupied. Here we have Orléans. That was besieged by the British in 1928. And this is crucial that this was besieged. It's also very key concerning communications and so forth. So that is the situation at that time. Let's go back.
Back?
No, I'm sorry. Next one, I mean back to the timeline. That was kind of what I thought. So... So we had the English entered Paris. Gaston, who was the president of the University of Paris, he has to flee. The one I just told you all this about, Brother of Common Life and so forth, he flees down south. And then 2 years later, you have the Treaty of Troyes, which really was like it looked like now France was destroyed. That's where you have this total agreement. That Henry V was the King of France, Charles VII was not king or could not become king, and the Queen of France and Isabeau is totally into that. Another guy, a French guy, Pierre Cochot, that we should hear much more about later on. I wrote him up there because it's kind of a strange name. He is also at that treaty in Troyes. It's a very destructive treaty, like a total, like, sellout treaty. And then I told you before when I showed you the map, in 1428, the English besieged Orléans, and I showed you where you had the city of Orléans. So... let's take the next. So now I'm jumping over a lot of things that I thought was not too important, so you have to go back yourself and read and have fun working with this. But here is Domremy. Joan of Arc has gotten some laterals at that time. She's gotten some help to get some helpers. She's convinced a few leading people in Vaucouleurs about her mission. And she decides to go with these few people 300 miles through enemy territory. Can we see the last one actually so people can see it's enemy territory? You can remember how we had Domremy up there? Remember that? How Domremy was this little enclave? And in order to get to where the King of France was, and the Crown Prince of France, to Chinon, most of the 300 miles was through enemy territory. So she does that, and people get scared and so forth, and she said, don't worry, we have God on our side, we will get there. So next, and all these white dots, this is always occupied by the British. Next. And this is Chinon, where the crown prince is called, in French it's called Dauphin, but just to make some more crown, I'll just call him crown prince. But that is the son, this is Charles the VII, who is the son of Charles the VI and Isabeau. He's the guy that Isabeau says, this is not my son, therefore he's not legit.
He has to be her son.
He's not the father. I'm sorry. It's the father. Yeah, yeah. The father is not Charles the VI. Thanks, Tom. Anyway, so when she is here, she is for 2 days. By the way, there's all kind of fun stories that I'll jump over. But for 2 days, the king is trying to avoid her. He's a real, as you would say in Danish, cotton prick. He is really like. Yeah, he is really a coward, right? Yeah, I use that all the time in America. People really like it. Yeah. So he avoids her for a couple of days, and then it doesn't sound so bad in English as in Danish. So anyway, so he avoids her and so forth, but then she has an encounter with him. She immediately knows who he is. And she is sent for 1 month or 3.5 weeks for investigation at a place called Poitiers. And guess who is in the middle of this whole thing? This is another picture of Gaston, this guy. So this Gaston, who had fled Paris when Paris was invaded by the British, who had defended the Brethren of Common Life, defended the right for all citizens, for all kids to have an education, who also would make the education program for Louis the 11th. He sits there together with other people that have fled the University of Paris, and for 3.5 weeks they are meeting for 6 to 9 hours a day with Joan of Arc. And it's a total investigation, and for sure other things were happening too. There was scribes that took down every single thing that was going on. So, unfortunately, that's lost. We have never found all these notes for these 3.5 weeks. And when she was not in there being investigated and discussions and what was going on, she was out training on her horse using sword and lances and so forth. So, after these 3.5 weeks, she is being cleared that she is fine, that she can get the French army and lead the French army. So Peter, obviously, okay. So obviously, the something that we don't know about, something was going on, that she would get the French army. So she gets 7,000 troops to lead, and she gets food for those 7,000. To lead, and also this takes a few weeks. So after she's finished with this investigation, all the soldiers are getting together, all the food for the soldiers, horses, artillery, and so forth, and a lot of priests. And then she marches with the army, with the priests in the front, singing Veni, Veni Spiritus. Come the Creator or something, or the Spirit. So if you can have, if you can have see this scene where people are marching, first with all the priests singing and then all the soldiers and so forth. And immediately, at the beginning when they begin to march, she had sent a letter to the British with a messenger, the British that are surrounding Orléans, saying, look, you should surrender. I'm coming, you should surrender, I'm on a mission, and you will lose. So in order not to have any bloodshed, surrender. And this does not, and also what she does, she all kinds of, when the soldiers are getting together and on the way to Orléans, she's going in organizing at the different public marketplaces and so forth, telling people that now Orléans is going to be freed, and to get people completely optimistic that this is her mission, and she is on a mission from God. And when she arrives Orléans, she rides in the evening on a black horse in white armor, and she has a very special standard with her, you know, concerning her flag, and which is the one to mark to, yes.
Yeah, wouldn't you call it the English more in that time? I mean,
what did I say?
No, it's got, I mean, between the British.
Yeah, the English.
That time it's
yeah.
English.
Yeah, what did I say?
No,
I said the British.
British.
Oh, okay. So the next, yeah. The next. So just a little thing, because people kept asking me about this fleur de lis. So that's how this looks like. Next.
That's a flag?
Yeah, but that's just part of it. There's all kinds of things on also with Jesus Christ, and I was never able to get a good picture of it. I tried, so.
Is it Lilia or something?
The Lilia,
yeah.
Yeah. The Diapo or Soda or Jesus, Jesus, we have to stay in English, and so on and so forth. So, this is one of the most celebrated battles in the Hundred Years' War, if not the most celebrated battle. And that alone could be a whole discussion for at least 1 hour. So I want to say I'm not going to pay the respect, because then it will take, because I want to get to something else and not the battles, because she was a fantastic military leader. She was like really good, like a George Washington. And here she was. She was 17 years old. She rode a horse. The description of her is like when she rode a horse, this is like the descriptions of George Washington, and I kind of like to compare them because they're so different. Because he was a gigantic guy and a little bit older when he started the Revolutionary War, and here you have this 17-year-old woman. But she was famous for how she was like one with a horse, so was George Washington. And she... one thing that was, there's several books, there's a very good book written about her concerning Joan of Arc as a military leader, because what she did, as George Washington did, and other great military leaders before then, is she changed the rules of the game, where the British, they will attack and withdraw, and they have very special rules for how you do everything, and the British, the English, excuse me, how... she was there to win, and she used flanking all the time. She also used direct attack, which they were not used to in that fashion. She would make a different use of artillery that has never been used before. So she didn't think about, okay, now go to war like we have gone to war throughout the Hundred Years' War. No, she kind of thought, okay, how am I going to win as fast as possible? And she had a mission to win. And that's what changes the way you think, that the intention that you have shapes the way you think. And so she was extraordinary, and you will have to look that into that more yourself. She asks, so what she does, she gets a lot of food, and because Orléans has been, here you have this city that has been occupied for a year. So people don't have a lot of food and this kind of stuff. So she gets tons of food and ammunition and so forth into Orléans, I think, from the west. While there's all kinds of battles down here to kind of distract their attention. And then she two times says to the British, she calls them, you have to withdraw, you're going to lose. They call her a whore and whatnot. And they call the soldiers that work with her, they say they're just all pimps, and they're trying to really kind of, and then she sent a third message with an arrow over, this is the last warning, you're going to lose. And she sends next, she when she charges, when she goes into the battle, she's known for being in the front with her flag, always in the front, and she's wounded. Several times people say, let's wait for reinforcement. The king has said reinforcements are going to come, and she says, no. That is, people that are 10, 20 years older than her, say, soldiers, officially officers and so forth, they tell this 17-year-old, we don't have enough troops, we should wait, we shouldn't do that, and she says, no. My counsel is different from your counsel. We go to attack. And at one point when there's a special drawbridge where there is a guy there who is one. I think he's the mayor of the town, if I'm not mistaken. He refuses to put down the bridge so that Joan of Arc can lead the army out to attack the English. And Joan says, with her sword drawn, "I'm going to cut off your head if you don't draw down, if you don't let the bridge down." And the bridge goes down. They go out, and she wins. Huh? She says from the very beginning, 5 days, and Orléans will be freed. How is she doing that? She is really at the very best sign. An image of a warrior angel, because every day before she goes into battle, she has to go to confession. And sometimes when she wants to have an early battle, it's an early confession. She wants all the soldiers to go to confession. She will have absolutely no swearing, no women with the army, no playing of cards, no drinking. People have to be pure. In order to win this fight, for France, you have to be pure in your spirit in order to do that. So she is very, after the first battle, then her celebration is to go to the church to pray and give thanks and so forth and prepare for the next battle. And so that is her, the whole spirit that she, this is serious, and therefore you have to have your mind and your heart has to be pure in order to win this battle. And she is herself the key example of it. So she also, for example, she's a special person, yeah, but she's a young woman. There's many cases where she cries. When she first time gets wounded, she's scared. She gets wounded right here on the top of her breast, and she sees the blood and she gets scared. And other times where she cries and so forth and pulls herself together. She also, concerning purity and how she thinks, she feels very sorry for the British. When she says, "Look, give up," she really don't want people to be killed. She, for example, one of the people describes that one of the French soldiers had slain a British soldier and taking him for dead, and Joan sees that he's still alive, so she rushes over to the British soldier, to the English soldier, put his head in her lap and comforts him and hear his confession so that he can die in that way. So she is very much also like in a war for justice with a Revolutionary War, where Washington made sure that the prisoners were taken very good care of. When the British at that time took prisoners, then you can call them English and British, then they would, very much the Hessians in the Revolutionary War, when that would take place, they would kill them or starve them. But Washington, because this was a just war, for just principles, he wanted to make sure that the prisoners were taken good care of. And Joan of Arc is the same. It's the same way. So the British, or the English, they leave next. And now I'm going completely. Oh, that this is the cathedral that is still standing today, where she celebrated with mass, with a special mass after the victory in over the English in Orléans. Next. And this spread like wildfire. Here you have, and you have to really, this is not a just like a nice story. This is real. And you have the French troops led by French officers, experienced older guys with military training, losing battle after battle. And there comes this peasant girl who used to just take care of sheep in a little village, and there she comes, rides her horse, commands around with all these military officers, and whenever they are cowards, she tells them, "Stop being cowards, follow me." And sometimes she rushes out to battle so fast that they can hardly follow after her. And she wins. So this is like a complete, people think about this as a miracle, or the English thinks about this as a spooky thing. I mean, somebody with supernatural powers and so on. And but the news spreads really fast. And this is the only drawing. This is the news about this, that Orléans has fallen. And the scribe that wrote that, he sat there and fantasized a little bit and wrote and made this little drawing out there, where you see this gigantic sword in combination with the body. And that's the only illustration from the time of her life, was this scribe in Paris writing about the fall of Orléans. So let's take the next. Yeah. So Joan of Arc's voices have told her that she should go to, she should get her crown prince, the Dauphin, crowned in Reims, and she should do it as fast as possible.
When did she win the
Orléans? Exactly as you said, 5 days later. I think it took a total of 9 days.
1420?
Oh, no, 1429. Let me just, yeah. May the 8th, 1429. So, as an introduction to this going to Reims, already there again, people are getting scared. I mean, I told you this in the battle in Orléans, you have people saying again and again, no, let's wait for reinforcement, no, let's go not do it now, and she just keeps pushing and pushing. And right after there, after Orléans, there is a meeting in the King's Council, and she's not allowed in. And she literally bursts into the council because they are cowards. And she, let's see here, I should actually read it up. 110. Let's see here. Yeah. So that's the introduction. So the maid coming in. Fell on her knees and embraced the king's legs, saying these words or others like them: "Noble Dauphin, hold not such and such long counsel, but go to Reims as soon as possible to receive a fitting crown." And there's all kinds of people around the king at that time saying, "Why should we do that?" Kind of like mocking her a little bit, as if she's not real and so forth. But the crown prince decides to listen to her, and she is taking him to Reims. But in order to go to Reims, yes? Oh, I thought you had. In order to go to Reims, you have to go through enemy territory. She has to win battles. This is, when they go to Reims, this is the route back after Reims. When they go to Reims, this is the straight line, or the straight, without being the, without the dotted ones, up. And here is Reims. So, but she has to win battles in all these cities, or all these towns on the way. And the first one she comes to, she starts off the 10th with one battle. The second one is a town called Pathé, which is not there. And she says to, in the evening, she says to the officers, "For the battle tomorrow, put on some good spurs." And this is a battle where the English is led by a very famous guy called Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T. And they say, "We should have good spurs." You know what spurs are? What you, this is what you have to tickle the horses with?
Spore.
Spore, yeah. So she says, "Put on some good spurs." And they say to her, "Why? Are we going to flee?" And she says, "No, the English are going to run so fast that we're going to really use the spurs in order to keep up with them." Okay. And it's exactly what she says. Talbot, the English, thinks they're doing a great job. And Joan of Arc flanks them like crazy, and they flee. And it was a tremendous... the English loses 2,000 people. 2,000 dead of the English, 3 French soldiers dead. So this is that... And you have, for example, when they come to Troyes here, remember I told you about how you had this treaty in 1420 where France was sold out. And when they come to Troy again, there is cowardice. And she pushes on. Let me. It just happens again and again, so I'll just give you a couple of examples. Again, people around the king have a meeting with the king to hold back. Don't do it. Don't go into a Troy. Don't do it. And she goes, again, she is not invited, so she comes into the council, and she says, "Noble Dauphin," that is Crown Prince, "order that your people go and besiege the town of Troy and stay no longer in council, for in God's name, within 3 days I will take you into the city of Troy by love or by force or by courage, and false Burgundy will stand amazed." And she immediately takes the arm, she leaves the council, takes the army, and takes Troy. Actually, Troy lays down its arms. They are just so, some people are very encouraged and excited, and others are scared and give up. So, I want to say some of the same things happens where with rams, and it is amazing what is happening. See, I want to, one thing I should tell you concerning this thing with the important, why is it so important that the king gets crowned? Because before the crown prince is crowned, people can't, he's not really king. He has to get the blessing of God, and it has to be done in that specific city, and it has to be done with very specific rituals. So therefore, he's not legitimate under God as a king of France before he's been crowned in Reims. That's why it is so important. Because then people will believe when he is crowned that, okay, this is God's will, it is God's blessing, now he is a king under God. So, some of the same thing happens with Reims, which is also more important because of the statue of Reims. But where it's from the papacy, let me see here, where is it now? Yeah, this is a future pope who wrote a very long report about Joan of Arc's military victories. And he says about when they came to Reims, the city of Reims, he writes, "The city sent eminent citizens to request time for consideration, but the maid gave orders that the envoys should receive no answer. There must be no delay. Everything must be done at the time that God appointed. The Dauphin obeyed the maid. He detained the envoys, and sending ahead some companies of cavalry, advanced swiftly onto the city. Then an extraordinary thing happened, which after generations will not believe. Not a single armed man was to be found at the gate or in the city. The citizens in civil dress met them outside the walls. The Dauphin, without conditions, without terms, without the least opposition, passed through wide open gates. No one protested, no one showed any sign of resentment." So after a number of victories and coming close to Reims, through the determination of this young woman, people are beginning to be respectful and also optimistic that there is a change. Yes, Hans?
Have you told about the Dauphin that's
Crown Prince.
Okay,
yeah. So that was just when you slept. I couldn't help it.
Maybe I'm not
giving you. If you're giving me a hard time, I'll give you a hard time. So thousands are volunteering for the army, and there's so many descriptions of how the army is transformed and how the army is inspired by Joan of Arc. And again and again at the trial, the people are saying, look, not only were nobody allowed to think of sex and have anything to do with women or drinking or games or so forth, but people that were close to Joan of Arc, I mean, she had male clothes on and she would bathe with them and dress change clothes and so forth, but as a man, although she was a woman. But they say that there was never any sexual fantasies. They completely disappeared. And one of them, one of the officers, who's a count, in the testimony, he says, when they were in the maid's company, they had no wish or desire to approach or have intercourse with women. And it seemed to him that this was almost a miracle. That is, that the idea of what the mission was and what they were fighting for, led by her example, got people to become much more concentrated and focused on a higher goal of why they were fighting. So now the king is crowned. And people at the crowning, people said, why, how come that your banner should be so prominently at the crowning process? And she said, look, this banner did a lot of work, so it's only right that it got this honor at the crowning. And her reaction right after the crowning was that she comes in to the king, she kneels in front of him and, quote, embracing him round the legs, said to him whilst shedding tears wildly, quote, gentle king, now is done God's pleasure, who willed that I raise the siege of Orléans, and that I bring you to this city of Reims to receive your holy sacring, showing that you are true king and him to whom the kingdom of God should belong. And it then describes how people felt very sorry for her at that moment, because she was really very emotionally and cried a lot. And this, now again, thousands and thousands of people are joining the army, but there is a shift. I mean, as I said before, this Battle of Orléans was the most discussed battle in all of the 120 years of the Hundred Years' War, and the English and the Burgundians tried to keep it down and so forth, because it was tremendous remoralization that this had happened. And also, people did believe that this bad woman, some people called her a whore, but a bad woman had destroyed France, and a virgin was going to win it, and that was indeed what, win it back, and that was indeed what was happening now. So after the crowning, Joan sends a very beautiful letter to the Duke of Burgundy. Remember, Burgundy was partly French, and they're occupying France together with the English. And he's a cousin to the king, who is now being crowned to Charles VI. They're cousins, right? So she sends a very beautiful letter, which is really like a Peace of Westphalia letter. Let's collaborate around the development of France and so forth. And in the meantime, the King of France has a council, and he makes a truce with the English and with the Burgundians. Joan of Arc is not involved, and it is a complete fraud. It's a complete joke, not a joke. It's a complete trick. In order for the English to win time, the English and the Burgundians to win time, so that they have a truce where we are not going to fight at all, and then in that time the English get another 3,500 troops over from England to fight in France. And now Joan is getting more and more, the king is more and more listening to these other people's advice, and she's going against Paris, and she has a very good position, but she's being completely sabotaged. This is a whole long story in itself that I'm not going to go through, but suffice it to say that she has built a bridge to storm Paris, and the king orders that it be destroyed and orders her back. And then she cannot do anything. When the king orders her not to go, she cannot do anything. So there is through the advisors around the king, the guy who is now crowned, Joan gets less and less support. And in September, we are still in 1429, so we had the freeing of Orléans in May, in the beginning of May, that we had the crowning in the 16th of July, and then in September the king disbands the army. And now we are in the very last phase of Joan's active life. And and there is these writings, these testimonies later that we hear that Joan knows that now she's very soon going to be captured. She knows she's going to give her life. She just doesn't know how and when. That's also what she's been known, that her mission is to free Orléans and get the king crowned. But then she's going to lose her life. And again, this is a whole... Can I have the next, please? That's what I was going to show. This is the Castille de Reims. It still looks like that. Actually, I took the picture where the kings of France used to be crowned. Next. This is the tower where she is being... the bridge is being pulled up. She's left outside with a few soldiers, and this is where she's being captured. She's being captured in... May 23rd, 1430, that is a year after the freeing of Orléans, she's taken prisoner. Next. And she is taken all the way till Rouen. You can see over there, this place here. And this is where she is being held in a specific place for 5 months. And then she's being sold to the British, to the English. And she's actually arriving just before Christmas in at Rouen in 1430, after she's been sold to the British. Next.
Who captured her?
This was the Burgundians. The French captured her. They kept her. And there was all kinds of efforts to see from some people whether she could be freed and so forth. But there was too many intrigues and so on, and they sold her to the English. I mean, this is very French, for again and again in French history, where the French has been completely like metaphorically spreading their legs for the British, again and again, being the underdog for the British. And that was definitely the case in this whole period with the occupation of France, and also in the case of Joan of Arc.
In Paris was the Burgundians.
Yeah.
Paris at that time.
Yeah. If you remember, go back and remember... No, the English was, I'm sorry. If you go, but they collaborated with each other. Huh? But if you go back and look at the, or think about the map I showed of France in 1429, that has not changed, where Paris is part of what English England controlled. And then up in the north-east, you had, and also in the north-south, you had the Burgundians.
Southeast.
Southeast. Yeah. But this also belonged to, at that time, to France. Okay, next. Yes?
This thing with the Burgundians, has there ever been like a war between Burgundy and the rest of France? Has it caused problems later that are they seen as traitors?
I don't know. It was family stuff, and I was starting looking into it because there was whole very interesting stuff concerning like what you have typical nasty intrigues, which is a whole other story to get into, and I don't know if I can get it totally correct today, so I'm not going to get into it. But it was something like somebody killed one of the Burgundians that was used to then make a split between the Burgundians and another faction called the Armagnacs, or I don't know if I pronounce it right, and so that you have this, make an assassination, accuse somebody else of having done it, and then you can split people up. Typical way of instigating wars and split up a nation. I mean, it's being used today. So that was kind of, but I, to be honest with you now, I forgot the exact details, but I know that this is what happened. And they have all these funny names, so I forgot exactly what the names was of the guy that got killed and blah, blah. So but it was French. They were kind of set up against each other. And the result was the nation of France was being destroyed, sold out to the English, literally. So she's sold to the English, and she's being brought to this tower that is still there today, tower in Rouen. And I have to make sure I have my notes here. And you have a trial that takes place against her from January the 9th. So she's being brought the 23rd, 24th of December in 1430. She's being brought to this place in Rouen, in this tower. And from January the 9th to May the 30th, 1431, then she is at trial. And she's at trial from 6 to 9 hours every day. And what the whole trial, what that becomes is a trial against her accusers, which is very important. I would say the trial becomes a trial, they're trying to get her tried for being a heretic in Kedah. Instead, what this young woman does, who is now either 18 or 19, she dies when she's 19, so I don't exactly know when her birthday is, but you can say her active political life was between 17 and 19. So instead of these guys at the trial getting her, she's putting them on in the court. The court of justice, the cause of righteousness and truth. And I hope we can show it a little bit with some help how she does that. And again, because, and this is very important for the work that we are doing today, the intent that you shape in your own mind, and you can shape your intent, you can will your intent, and your intent shapes the way you think. If you're kind of just kind of doing good things and just a little bit good stuff, but you are not really on the mission, you cannot really think, you will not really get new ideas and so forth, because your intent is on a lower level. And for those of you who have tried it, when you really think about the world at large and the next generations to come and what needs to be done in the world, and you really mobilize yourself on the highest level, which I know Tom is going to discuss to a certain degree on Monday, then you know how that intent shapes the way you think. The geometry of the way the laws that guides your mind change comes much more in accordance to the universe, and that's how we want to be all the time. It's a big struggle to be like that all the time. That's what Joan of Arc was. That's why she's a very good example, and that's actually why she can do what she does, being so young. So, and being in this horrific situation. Let me give you a little sense of the situation. And a little bit later, I'm going to show you just a very short clip from a movie that I'll recommend you to later to borrow and to see. But so she's sitting in this tower. She is day and night guarded by 3 to 4 English jailers, men, all men. And they link her to the bed, and they link the bed, they chain the bed, the bed also, so they cannot be moved. She is treated horrendously, where they mock her, they put false crowns on her head, they mock her, they call her a whore, they try to grab her all over her body, being a woman cannot do anything, and they are very uneducated and dirty. So that's where she is. And then every day she's taken from that jail, and being brought to a courthouse where, if you can imagine, you have these pompous, fat priests. The leading one is a bishop called Pierre Gouchon, the second name I wrote up there. And I'm going to tell you, I'll give you some details just to paint the picture a little bit more, who are the wise in high places. Remember I read this up from Paul's letter that she's fighting against. So this, you can imagine this Pierre Gouchon, who is a bishop and an older guy, and he's with the church, right? And you have all kinds of other church people, bishops, priests, and so forth. They're sitting up there as judges. There's 60 of them. So you have this 18-year-old girl and 60 judges, and all bishops and priests and so on. And then you have all the scribes. There's a bunch of scribes sitting, taking note of every single thing that happens. And then there is a second set of scribes sitting behind a curtain, taking notes in secret. That is, they omit everything that is good for Joan and make a false writing. And then there's one guy who writes secretly everything down in French, because he really likes Joan and he wants to make sure everything is noted down. So what you have heard so far when I read up quotes, and what you're going to hear from now on also, is that every single thing is documented by witnesses. It's written down, or it's verbal witnesses, first with one trial, and then a couple of decades after her death, a second trial. So this is the most well-documented individual and what happened to her that we have from those times. Because never will all these things that people said and did be noted down like that. So this is not something that I had kind of gotten that was cooked up in different books and then I made a nice story. This is actually what was said. Huh? So you have this scene with the 60 judges, and also what they do, they take some women and examine if she's still a virgin. This kind of stuff, because they call her whore. Some of these judges call her whore, and so on. So it's a very political trial, and I'll come to this a little bit later, and if I forget, please remind me. But what you also should know is that this trial is public for 1 week, because this young woman is so sublime and so truthful and shapes her mind with this in such extent that immediately, as I said before, she puts her accusers, these old bishops and so forth, she puts them on trial. And they look so bad that after 1 week they close down for the public. It becomes a secret trial. Hmm? So already after 1 week, this young 18-year-old woman, through standing up for truth, has won all these bastards. Hmm? So I want to also the judges, some of them really like Joan. Some of them refuses to come, and they get threatened that they had to come. Some of them that defend her are being threatened by being killed or by being thrown in jail. One guy actually gets thrown in jail on water and bread for a long period because he says something nice about Joan. And then there's the other kind that gets money for being in the trial. So that's the scenery. I want to give you a little bit about this guy, Pierre Gouchon, because to give you an idea how this is functioning politically and what she upsets, the avocat that she upsets. So bear with me, stay concentrated so you kind of get a little sense of it, because you will have to get this. And he's born in 1371, so that means that he is 40 years older than Joan. So when we have the trial taking place, then he's about 40 years old. And he hates her. No, because he is 30. No, he's 50. Sorry. No, 60. You're right. It's my... yeah, okay. It's because it's English and I don't add up so fine. Thanks. He's 60. I thought he was 60. I thought he's only 40. I always thought he was 60. So it's kind of funny. He was one of the key people when you had Paris being attacked, leading that. He also was part of the gang that burned down Gerson's house in Paris. I mean, it was not enough to kind of just throw them out of Paris and so forth. His house had to be burned down. So this bishop was part of that. He is part of the Council of Constance, and he's part of that for the Duke of Burgundy. And let me just quickly, I'm not going to talk a lot about it, we can discuss it later, but Lynn was actually very excited about that this was mentioned in this book, which I'll warmly recommend, this book. It's a very good book, which has both the trial and the retrial. It's a very solid book. And Lynn read it and he recommended it. So just quickly what this is about. I told you earlier you had this schism of the church, and they had these councils of people from the different parts of Europe, mostly priests and so forth. For years these councils would take place, and they, the reason they called the Council of Constance, would take place in a place called Constance. And then it was moved to another city called Basel, and then it was moved to Florence. And so the first it sits for years, as I said, and they're discussing what the church should think, what the credo should be, and so forth for the church, and so on. And so at the first council, he is there, this guy Pierre Gouchot, he's there on behalf of the Burgundians. Then he, because he gets to the Council of Basel, there he's sent by the King of England. He's the deputy to the council for the King of England. And those councils too are the good representatives of the church, among other Cusa that I mentioned before, where I showed you how close Cusa is born also with Joan of Arc. And, for example, in the Council of Basel, the two factions at the Council of Basel is Cusa on the one side and Pierre Gouchot on the other side. So bear this in mind when we get to discuss the Council of Florence, because the Council, and let me just pick it up now, the Council of Florence, which is for a longer discussion, which took place in 1439, it was led by Cusa, had a real breakthrough concerning unifying the church. And that was around an idea of the consubstantiality between the Holy Spirit, the Father, and the Son. It's a long discussion, but the basic meaning is that that man is very like to God in terms of being able to participate in the creation process. The Capax Dei and also Imago Vivi Dei, that man is in the image of the Creator. And so for the first time, although this had been in Christianity before, it was made totally clear that man had the same qualities as the universe and could therefore participate with the universe in the creation process. And so this was so it was a very important epistemological battle in Europe at that time. And the key judge, the leading judge against Joan of Arc, was head to head with Cusa in at these councils. Okay?
Can you explain shortly? I don't know. Do you know who Cusa is?
No. Okay. Okay. I will do that, and if I forget, tell me. Okay, I'll do that a little bit later, but if I forget, tell me. Maybe we can actually have some fun with somebody tomorrow too. So he was also, Pierre Gouchot, he was also a leading person in the Treaty of Troyes. Remember I told you that, 1420, where France sold out and the King of England became King of France. And he was the counselor to the new King of England, Henry VI. He was chancellor for the Queen of England. He was deputy guardian to the Privy Seal. And on and on and on. I mean, he was working for the English like this. And so this is the leading Dutch of whom Joan of Arc is up against. And I would like now to go through... can we have the next one? I'm not totally sure which one this is. Yeah, okay. This is the gentleman. Can we have the next one? Yeah. So I would like to have this picture up when I would like to you to get a little sense, Tom and Maya, please, of just a little part of the how you should come up here. And you should stand, and Tom can sit, but you have to stand.
Should she be in trial, not me?
That's right, so she has chains on her. She has just come from the prison where she's been grabbed all over by the English jailers. It's probably the fourth or fifth hours standing up in chains with all these fat guys, 60 of them sitting in front of you. You just have to see the scene. She's 18. You have a panel of 60 judges up here. You have all these stripes sitting there taking notes. And they're just trying again and again to trick her. And I'll make a few comments now and then in between, but this is all as it happened. This is not something made up. This is transcribed from the trials, both the first trial and the second trial. So she's defiant.
Do you know whether Saints Catherine and Margaret hate the English?
They love that which God loves, and hate that which God hates.
Does God hate the English?
Of the love and hate which God has for the English, and of what he does to their souls, I know nothing. But well I know that they will be driven out of France, excepting those who will die there, and that God will send victory to the French over the English.
So she's defiant. She's defiant, and the next is where they want her to make an oath, but she was involved in state secrets. I mean, she was not just an 18-year-old leading the French army, she was also privy to state secrets. So now Pierre Gouchon wants her to make an oath, but she's not going to give up secret affairs of the state.
Swear to speak the truth with your hand on the holy evangels in all matters on which you will be questioned.
I do not know on what you will question me. It may happen that you will ask me a thing which I shall not tell you.
You will swear to speak the truth on what will be asked you concerning matters of faith and what you will know.
Of my father, of my mother, of all that I have done since I arrived in France, I will willingly swear, but the revelations made to me by God, I have told nothing, nor revealed to anybody, excepting only to Charles, my king, and I shall not reveal them, though it cost me my head. I have had that by my visions, by my secret counsel, to reveal them to nobody. In the next 8 days, I shall know whether I am to reveal them.
Swear to tell the truth in everything touching your faith.
So now comes, they're always trying to get her for heresy and try to trick her. And you have all these rules in the Catholic Church. Now they want her, the next thing where it's tricky, this is Pierre Gouchon, who's a priest, he's a bishop. So... He asked her to do something, and she says, if you hear my confession. See, as a priest, he cannot really refuse to hear her confession. On the other hand, if he hears her confession, there's also a secrecy rule. So what is, so again, here's how she handles a request from Pierre Gouchon.
Recite Pater Noster and Ave Maria.
I will say them willingly, provided you hear my confession.
Willingly will we order, appointed for you, one or two notable men who speak French, to whom you can say Pater Noster.
I shall not say it to them if they will not hear me in confession.
So again, the point is dropped because she is the strong one. And here you have how she makes fun of them, and they don't get her. Next.
This voice of which you ask counsel, has it face and eyes?
You shall not have that either. Little children say that sometimes men are hanged for having spoken the truth.
And she is defiant. She kept throughout the court case telling these judges up there, these 60 judges, French, who were working for the English, you are going to lose and France is going to win.
Do you know if you are in God's grace?
If I'm not, may God bring me to it. If I am, may God keep me in it. I should be the most grieved woman in the whole world if I knew myself not to be in the grace of God.
Go on, stop. No, because I made a mistake. This is really important too. This is, so just forget what I said because it comes next. This question about grace, Noel. If you say, this is her answer, so it's really important that I stopped it. Her answer is being discussed, has been discussed a lot by theologians and so on through the years, as being really special answer that she gives. Because if she says, they say, oh, so do you believe that you're in God's grace? If she says yes, then you take, then you're kind of taking that you know what God thinks in that way. I forget now. You take his, to take him in vain. Is that how he said it in English?
You take his name in vain.
His name in vain. And if you say you are not, well, then you're just a fraud. I mean, so you can think about if you were in her shoes, how would you answer that? So people have discussed later on, looking at her answer, that this was very unusual, that she could actually. They never ever. In this whole course of the trial, they never tricked her once. Where many priests and so forth would have been tricked on these kind of tricky questions, she never was tricked. And with that introduction, you start all over again with this one.
Do you know if you are in God's grace?
If I'm not, may God bring me to it. If I am, may God keep me in it. I should be the most grieved woman in all the world if I knew myself not to be in the grace of God. And were I in the state of sin, I think that the voice would not come to me, and I wish that all could hear it as well as I.
And now comes the one where she is defiant. Again and again what I said throughout the trial, she keeps telling these guys, look, you're going to lose. France is going to be reinstated. Forget about it. Next.
Before 7 years be passed, the English will lose a greater gage than they had at Orléans, and they will lose in all France. And the English will even suffer a greater loss than they ever had in France. And this will be by a great victory of God, which God will send to the French.
How do you know that?
I know it well by a revelation which has been made to me, and it will happen before 7 years. And I should be very vexed should it be so long deferred. I know it as well as I know that you are there in front of me.
When will this happen?
I know not the day nor the hour.
In what year will it happen?
That too you shall not have. but I would that it might be before St. John's Day.
And now we have a couple examples where she's sharp, and by the way, everything she says here comes through. They are going to lose. They lose. I mean, she is right on mark. Also because she has mobilized, she's getting all these priests to look really not reliable and nasty, and she mobilizes all the good people to fight through her actions. So now there's a couple of examples of where she's sharp and funny, and there's many of those, by the way.
These saints that appear to you, have they hair?
It is good to know.
How do they speak?
This voice is beautiful, sweet, and humble, and it speaks the French language.
Does not Saint Margaret speak the English tongue?
How should she speak English since she is not on the side of the English?
Take the next one.
Of what form was Saint Michael when he appeared to you?
I saw no crown on him, and of his clothes I saw nothing.
Was he naked?
Do you think that God cannot afford to clothe him?
Had he hair?
Why should it have been cut off?
And another one where you can see the contradiction. Mm-hmm.
What is the sign which you gave to your king when it came to you?
It is good and honorable, right credible, and the richest there be in the world. The sign is in my king's treasury.
Is it of gold, of silver, of precious stone, or a crown?
I shall tell you nothing more. Nobody could describe a thing so rich as the sign.
And now I have to tell a little where to the next one. Why don't we take the next one too?
After that revelation, do you believe that you cannot commit mortal sin?
I know nothing about that, but in all things I trust in God.
That answer is of great weight.
Wherefore I hold it to be a great treasure.
So now I really it's a, when you read the trial, this is really gruesome what they're doing to her, because three times they are trying to get her to sign a paper that she's guilty. And the first time they take her down in the cellar to a torture chamber, and they begin, they have all kind of things they are saying before what is coming, what she's answering, but they are really going after her to get her to get scared and get her to sign a guilty note. And she they begin to turn the wheels and so forth that are going to torture her, and here is what she answers.
Truly, though you were to have my limbs torn off and send my soul out of my body, I should not say otherwise. And if I did tell you otherwise, I should always thereafter say that you made me speak so by force.
A second time, you have to understand, she thinks that she thinks, and other people think, that she's going to die. And the English really don't want her to die, because they want her to be burned alive as an example. So they're sending doctors up into her cell and so on. But people think that she's going to die, so she asks for communion. And you have to understand, in all these months, she has not gotten communion.
What's communion?
Communion is when you call the Catholics, the Lutherans believe it's an example of Christ's blood and body. The Catholics believe this is actually Christ's blood and Christ's body. And it's very, very important for Catholics to get their communion. Nedver, yeah. It would not help, because it would not help Fiorita anyway. Nedver. Yeah. So for months and months, she's not been allowed to go to a church, and she has not gotten communion. So the first time they tried to get her to sign that she is guilty of torture. The second time is that So they think she's going to die, and she thinks it too. So she's asked if she could get communion before she dies. So you have these priests coming up with altar boys and candles and the blessed bread and wine and so on into her cell. She's lying there in bed, and they are just about to give her the bread with it, which is blessed and all this kind of stuff, and then the priest takes it away again, and she's so happy, and then the priest takes it away again and say, no, you first have to sign that you are guilty. And then she refuses to do that. She's totally sick, lying there, thinks she's going to die and so forth. And then when she refuses to sign it, they all walk out of her cell, and she's not allowed to get communion. And if you're not Catholic, it might be not so easy to understand, but this is really brutal. It is as brutal as confronting somebody with torture, just in a different way. And the third time this happens is on when she's on the fire heap, where they also want her to sign. And she does. She signs on the fire heap, and there's a whole discussion about that, because what is in the official papers is a long document of something like 48 or 50 lines. But what she actually signed, according to many witnesses, was a little short one of 6 to 8 lines. So there was two different ones. One was pulled out of the sleeve, according to many witnesses, that she signed, and then another one, much longer, was the one that was presented at the court. So, but that's a whole other discussion. What I would like to do is to show you a section from this movie I told you about. This is a silent movie from 1928 called The Passion of Joan of Arc. And I think after today that you might get a little bit more out of it. You should know, you should turn down, you should borrow it, you should turn down the music. And then it's a lot of work. It's not something you just sit and relax about and escape reality with. It's something you have to really work on it. And but it's very truthful to the history. Yes.
Is it made by this Danish?
Yes, Theodor Dreyer. Yeah. Okay. And shot in Valby. And you can get them in Danish subtitles, French subtitles, and English subtitles. I had wished this one was in English subtitles, but has Danish subtitles. But you'll get a certain sense of it. This starts where she has been on the fire heap, and she has signed. Oh yeah, that's to tell that. Don't start before I'm kind of ready with this. She has signed this that she's guilty. And here's the deal. She has been told that when you sign this, you are going to come in a prison, a church prison, with women as your guardians. They're going to take care of you. And so after, so as when she is finished, when she has done that, she says, where is Maya? Okay. I think this is the one. Yeah.
Come now among you men of the church. Take me to your prisons and let me no longer be in the hands of these English.
Take her to where you found her.
Which means that they're taking her back to the English male jailers, exactly where she came from. So she's now you can go and sit. And so she's exactly in the same situation before. She's in her jail cell. And so we got to see a very short section of this movie from 1928. You can borrow it in the library. Or what did you do?
It somehow had rewound itself.
Oh no.
To the
so let's forget about it. Let's forget about it then. Let's forget about it. It would be too much of a break. So, no movie. So now I just have to retrace my steps. I found exactly the right spot. Anyway. This is just an independent television here. Just forget about it. It's just distracting, Benjamin. Just forget about it. Let's see here. So she is. Then you have to come up again because I thought. I'm sorry, but I thought this was going to be in a movie clip. So she goes back to her cell, and she realizes that what she has done is wrong. And she's been promised that, but she's still not. She has been promised, okay, you're going to be in a church jail with women. You're going to get your women's clothes. And then it turns out she's going back to the same jail. She does get women's clothes. Because why is this so important? With see, one of the things she has been, they couldn't get anything on her. The only thing they could, they thought they could get something is that she had male clothes because she was a soldier, and she refuses to wear women's clothes. One of the reasons is it's much easier to the, for the guys to get to her in women's clothes in, than in male clothes. So she promises, okay, I'm going to put on women's clothes. And she goes back to her cell, put on the women's clothes, and then the next morning when she needs to go to the bathroom and so forth, it turns out that the jailers have stolen her women's clothes and put back the men clothes. And she tries to hold herself, but finally, and begs that she cannot get her women's clothes, but finally she has to go to the bathroom. So she puts on the male clothes and so forth, and they say, you are heretic, you have gone back. But anyway, that was before she got in the first time on the fire. And now she's back in the cell. They are treating her very badly, and she realizes, oh my God, this was wrong what I did. I should never have done this. And she calls the judges, the six leading judges. She said, I want the six leading judges to come to my cell. And they come to her cell, and she says, I regret what I did. I want to recant, to take back what I said. And they say, well, are you aware you're going to die? And she said, I want to withdraw what I said. And then Pierre Gauchon, who is in her cell, and Joan of Arc, this is the scene that you have, the very last.
Bishop, I die by you.
Ah, Joan, have patience, Ed. You die because you held not to what you had promised, and are returned to your first evil doing.
If you had put me in the prisons of the court of the church, and into the hands of competent and fitting keepers of the church, this would not have happened. That is why I appeal against you before God.
So she, again, in the cell where she knows she's going to die, she says, you are guilty, and I appeal to God that you are guilty. I die by you. So to the very end, so she's being brought, thanks. She's being brought, don't worry about it. She's being brought to... she's being brought to the I lost my thread here. Oh yeah, so she's brought to the fire a second time. Just forget about it. It's too late now, Tom. Right? And you have 800 soldiers, 800 English soldiers that are there to guard, to make sure she gets burned. And a lot of them have their own faggots, faggots, you should come up here, to carry to the fire. And on the fire, Joan requests that people pray for her. And also, if you can imagine, she starts standing up at the fire, saying, she calling upon God to forgive the people that made her come to this place and made her die by fire. And there's all these, it took half an hour where she's just praying and asking God for forgiveness, God to forgive the people that put her here. And there's all these witnesses describing how the people cried, including the soldiers and so forth, that because no matter what they tried, she was totally truthful and pure and sublime. So I would like the orders comes from her lips is Jesus. She calls out and then she dies, but she carries herself in this total sublime manner to the very end, this 18-19 year old girl. And I will have Christina next read up two, or this is from the movie from when I had it before. Take another one. Yeah. I'll have Christina read up this, and you can follow as she reads. This is one of the reactions, again, from the trial, the second trial read up as one of the reactions to her, to Joan's being burned. Joan being burned.
Okay. I heard say that Master Jean Tresor, secretary to the King of England, returning from Joan's execution, afflicted and groaning, wept lamentably over what he had seen in that place, and said indeed, "We are all lost, for we have burned a good and holy person," and that he believed that her soul was in God's hands, and that when she was in the midst of the flames, she had still declaimed the name of the Lord Jesus. That was common repute, and more or less all the people murmured that a great wrong and injustice has been done to John. After John's death, the English had the ashes gathered up and thrown into the Seine, because they feared lest she escaped. Or at least some say she had escaped.
And the next?
One of the English, a soldier who detested her extraordinarily, and who had sworn that with his own hand he would bear a faggot to John's pyre, to pull. And the moment when he was doing so and heard John calling upon the name of Jesus in her last moment, stood stupefied and as if in ecstasy, and was taken thence to a tavern near the old market, so that, drinking pilgrim, he might regain his senses. And after having eaten a meal with a brother of the order of preaching friars, this Englishman confessed by the mouth of his brother, who was himself English, that he had sinned gravely, and that he repented of what he had done against John, whom he held to be a saintly woman, for, as it seemed to him, this Englishman had himself seen, at the moment when John gave up the ghost, a white dove coming out of the sight towards France. And the executioner, on the same day after the midday meal, came to the convent of the preaching friars and said to me, as to Brother Martin Batvenu, that he greatly feared to be damned, for he had burned a holy woman.
Mm-hmm. And this is, I want to go through just a little bit how much of a political trial this is. Next. So you have the King of England. He issues a letter of warranty to everybody that's been part of this trial that he's going to help them if they're in trouble. On the word of a king, if it comes about that any of the persons that worked in the trial be brought to trial, summoned or sued for that trial or its dependencies, we will aid and defend, have aided and defended in the court of law and without, such persons at our own cost and expense. So, I don't know, some people, it might be difficult language, but basically says if you get persecuted, that is the King of England, regarding the court of Joan of Arc, we are going to help you with money, with lawyers, and so forth. So don't worry. And I just wanted to go through a number of points because concerning it being a political trial. Remember, the English, they bought her, right? She's kept in a prison with English guards. They pay the trial. The English pay the trial, and you also have, after the trial, a lot of the people that have been judges, they are now getting higher positions and so on. In the trial, there's no accusations as such. It's never, Joan never has a lawyer. It's just they are trying to see if they cannot find something on her by what she's saying, and they cannot. Also, this is so-called a church trial, but it's not. It's all run by the church, yes. But then she should be in a church prison with women guarding her, and instead she is in an ordinary prison with 3 to 4 English guys, men, guarding her. Then you have, of course, this one that I just read up to you. And there's many other things, but let me give you the last one, where after the trial, after she had been burned, right, the same man who had gotten Joan, he had actually, there's this description about this guy who helps Joan sign that she's guilty. So this same guy out there on the fire who does that, he asked the English Crown Treasurer to finance the construction of war machines for the siege of another city. So it's all money and dirty stuff and deals. If we kill this woman, if we do the dirty handiwork, then we're going to get money and so forth. So let me come to a conclusion where I'll come to Kusa. So what you have is in 14, so all what Joan of Arc had said at the trial concerning that the French are going to win and the English are going to lose, that all comes through. And the Burgundians and the Armagnacs also are making peace again. And one battle after the other is won. There is what you have with this trial is that it greatly helps the faction. Gerson is dead by this time, but Kusa is very active political organizing. And what you have through Joan of Arc acting in the way that she did, not giving in and standing up for truth and putting her accusers on trial, what that means is that the nasty factions of the church are getting exposed and are therefore getting dramatically weakened. And she is, her trial, and then as you will see, her retrial reorganizes not only the entire French population, but also the good parts of the church. So it's a very... battle after battle is won, and in 1449, 20 years after the Battle of Orléans, Rouen is freed. The place where she was sitting in jail is freed. And it is first then that they can begin to do something about a retrial. And then you remember the very first I read up the King's declaration, that was in 1450, that he now wants to have an investigation what happened at this trial. They can do this now because now the place is freed, the city of Rouen is freed. And what you have is that Joan's mother, she comes to Paris, she comes to Notre Dame where the proclamation is being read for the examination of this, and you have in all the churches all over France, they're asking for witnesses to come for the retrial. And there's 115 witnesses that come for the retrial that takes place for many, many weeks. So, and finally, in 1456, she is fully exonerated. And So you have, for example,
say what it, exonerated.
That means she's completely being freed of all accusations, and so again the her what she did, the trial, and now the retrial gets people to relive all what she did and get remoralized for all what she did, and again this is going throughout in all the pores of the French population, because they're really proud of her, and she signifies what a Frenchman should be. So and now to Cusa, because the day that Joan of Arc left to go through enemy territory to go to Chinon to see the king, that day Joan of Arc's mother and two of her brothers went down south to visit the an Augustinian monk order that Cusa worked very closely with. And we know from writings and saying that Cusa highly admired Joan. We also know what I said before, how Cusa was totally up against Pierre Gauchon at the councils. What he does at the Council of Basel is he writes the Concordantia Catholica, which I have to admit I have not read, but Lynn LaRouche have said that this was the basis for the ideas shaping the first nation state. So I have to study that still, and so should you, regarding the ideas outlined in there which guided Louis XI in forming the first nation state. Cusa was a crucial organizer, and LaRouche has often said how he was the founder of modern science. We are going to touch upon some of his ideas tonight, and I'm sure also Tom is going to take up certain things tomorrow. I mean, everything we do touches actually upon Cusa. Cusa called at that time upon for people to go to other places to get away from the oligarchy in Europe, to take the most beautiful ideas from Europe and plant them in places away from the oligarchy. And around him you had key map makers like Toscanelli and others who made maps, and these were the maps that were used by Columbus to come to America. So he was very instrumental also in he traveled to the United States, to the now the United States, to America by Columbus. He was the guy who led the fight next, actually. He was the one. Here we have Cusa. I had a picture of him. next. He was the one. This is a painting. That's one of my old slides I had scanned of all these people traveling from the east and the west to meet up in Florence, where they finally found a new cradle for the church and unified the Eastern and Western Church, which had been really used to create and foment wars and so forth. And again, Cusa was the key person holding that together and organizing for that. I would really highly recommend, regarding a nice introduction to Cusa, there's a many nice introductions, but there's a really very loving introduction, and that is to LaRouche's 65th year's birthday. His wife Helga wrote a paper. She asked for a book to be written which contained people's articles that they had written from something that LaRouche had inspired them to do. So here you have LaRouche's wife Helga, and she writes a beautiful article, and this is now 20 years ago and it's still beautiful. I just reread it recently, which she called On the Vision, On the Sweetness of Truth, which is inspired by one of Cusa's key writings. So if you want to kind of get a really fun beginning investigation of Kusa. That's a very beautiful way of starting. And if we had the if we had the text here, actually, we could read it when we're up here, but I doubt we have it here. Yeah, you have it? Okay, so that is not, this is not a long text. It's very beautiful. It's very inspiring. And it's a little bit like a mystery on a higher level to figure it out. It's very fun. It's very playful. So that was a little sidestep, but that was the Council of Florin and Kusa, and
sorry, when was
yeah?
the Council of
Florin? 1439. Yeah. And so this is obviously years before you have the retrial. So then you have the retrial of Joan of Arc. You have her exoneration in 1456, which again recalls everything that happened and re-mobilizes. It's like it's playing it again, and people's deepest emotions and so forth getting aroused again in the retrial. And then 4 years after that, you have Louis the XI being crowned to king. He actually had to flee away from his father at a certain point. He was just waiting for his father to die so he could become king. And as I said long time ago, so therefore I'm going to repeat it, Gaston, the guy who defended Joan of Arc, the guy who worked, who was also the key person investigating her at Poitiers before she started going out fighting, who worked with the Brethren of Common Life for education for everybody. He was the one who wrote the education program for Louis XI. Actually, the Louis XI had met Joan of Arc when he was a little kid. And then a very important thing that I said before, Kusa's writing, Concordantia Catholica, is also the basis and was studied by Louis XI as a basis for his government. He had actually prepared himself to get into power and to change France, because now France was freed. But that's not enough. You had all these feudal lords all over in France who were just trying to get their own little regional power. And what he did, and there's a very nice article, I'll just point out where you find it, in this issue of Fidelio. It's a very thoroughly investigated research about Louis XI, and there's also a first ever translation of a paper he wrote called The Rosebush. So I will not go through that. I'll just refer to it for you to read it. But what he did briefly, he for the first time made the country of France should be governed in such a way that it's good for all the people living in France. That is, the commonwealth should, the country and the wealth that the country should could produce should be shared by everybody. So the way he did his tax policies and so forth was to produce that. He very massively, through tax policies and other policies, diminished the feudal lord's power, and they hated him. And he made major infrastructure programs, industrial programs, agricultural improvements, and so forth. So in the 20 years of his reign, France completely changed, and did indeed become, there's all kinds of writings about France was an example for the rest of the world concerning, because what was really treasured was the education and the skill of the population and how fast the skill of the population could grow to the benefit of all. And in a very direct sense, from Joan of Arc making sure to win Orléans, remoralize the French population, get the king crowded ranks, from France being a complete destroyed nation, and then Kusa, it was not only Joan of Arc, but the French population being inspired, Kusa carrying on the work he is doing, her putting all her accusers on the defensive, remoralizing the good people, arousing France for what it really should be. And you have the other people in her faction, Gerson, and I mentioned Cousin. This leads, because of what she does in reawakening France, to that Louis XI can make the first nation state in the world. So I would like to end with highly recommend for anyone who has not read, or also for people who have read it all the time, it can be read about once a month, Schiller's writing on the sublime. Because, and generally Schiller, because in order, the world, Joseph made it very clear last night, the world is a very, it's in a very precarious situation. You heard what Peter said at lunch, he read up from Lynn. And every one of us either escape sometimes, or a lot of times, or we get scared, or we get discouraged, and therefore each one of us had to arm ourselves on a daily basis and every day throughout the day to become stronger and better and more insightful, and we had to help each other to do it. That is, alone it's really difficult, if not impossible. Joan of Arc had her people around her too. She then was the driving force. And some of us, and you here in this room, have to be the driving force where other people then gather around you. But each one of us had to find strength in by different ways, like reading Helga's On the Sweetness of Truth. But also I will definitely recommend Schiller's writing on the sublime. Because, I mean, in the process of, I mean, one thing is you... that you have an urge to be good. But that's not enough. You have to then get a moral and intellectual strength that you have to build up on a daily basis. And you can get the help from good examples and good writings that has been produced from the past. And therefore, Schiller, of course, Linda LaRouche, but when it comes to the question about the development of the emotions, where Schiller says, unless you develop your emotions to become more and more noble, you have to learn to desire nobly. And if you look at the desires in the Danish society today, not just in the Danish, but if you look at the desires, I mean, you can imagine the Danes today over Pentecost, what they are doing. So they are not very noble. And Schiller points out that unless you really work on learning to desire more nobly, you are not going to be able to act in a sublime level when it's necessary for you to act on a sublime level. That is, this is something that you have to work on, becoming more and more noble, becoming more and more beautiful as a human being. And then, when it's necessary, you might be able to act on a sublime level. But if you don't nourish that side of you, you will not. And it's not every day history gets a Socrates, or a Lincoln, or a Joan of Arc, but we can help the process to using ourselves as the very best and most potent tools possible when we are alive. And actually, when you do that, when you kind of kick yourself in the butt and pull yourself together and laugh at yourself and so on, that's actually when you feel the very best happy. That's actually when life is really great. And you can enjoy the water much better in a different way, not escaping, but in a total different way. If you can be happy that you are alive today to do good, because you know who you are, you know you have a purpose in life, and that you stand on the shoulders of people that came before you, and we are in an incredible important fight today. And every single one of us, every single one in this room, and people that are connected with this movement outside of this room have a role to play. It is not it's going to be done by each one of us doing our utmost, developing ourselves to that end. And I would like to end by having Christina come up. Because we had in America a very special young man who also knew that he was going to be assassinated. And his house with his wife and children inside was bombed several times. And most of the time when people have a family, when the family is being threatened, then they stop fighting. But he did not. And he also knew that he would die, that he would be killed. And this was Martin Luther King. And this is the excerpt that Christina is going to read, because he, in his own way, was like a Joan of Arc, just in another time. And so this speech is just a few days before he's assassinated. And he already have a foreboding, like Joan of Arc had voices that told her that she was going to die, that she had a mission and she was going to die. Well, Martin Luther King had his voices.
And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I looked over and I seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
That's it. So they got, they are both young and they're both immortal.
Yeah.
Their death was, you know, so. Questions? You got it? You got how the First Nation State was formed? You got through? All right. Okay. Or you're just polite. Yeah.
Do you think Chandak herself had the idea as such?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't
think
so.
Or?
Well, it came from Kusa, yeah. And there's very strong circumstantial evidence that her mother and brothers were encountered with Kusa and so forth. We know Kusa would travel through. We know the church that she went at as a kid, also Kusa went to and so forth. But this is all circumstantial. But we do know that Kusa admired her. We do know this with the councils, which were crucial. And we do know that Kusa wrote, we know that Gaston, who was close to Joan of Arc and was together with her physically, that he was very heavily involved in this whole thing. So, yeah?
It may be a silly question, but
okay. Sometimes the silly questions are the best. Maybe not now, but let's see.
I can't promise.
Okay.
No, but just wondering, what do you think? You know, why was it her? Why was she so special? I mean, is this so? Can you train yourself to be as noble and sublime as her, or?
Well, you can ask a question.
Was it her faith?
It's funny, isn't it? Because why is Linda LaRouche's son not better than he is? How does Linda LaRouche? How was he created? What about Martin Luther King? Why did he become special? Why did Lincoln become special? I think that often you have certain circumstances, obviously, that forms a human being. Mm-hmm. She was, as I said earlier, very religious and so forth. And then you have sometimes, there are certain cases where older people will give advice to a young child and it will stick there. And then there's crucial periods where you have to make a decision what you're going to do with your life.
Because that, well, then he says that, you know, he doesn't have to be the best leader. Sometimes the situation chooses
mm-hmm.
the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And
like, for example, I think I have really studied John Quincy Adams. I really love that man. And I then sometimes thought, and I know Lincoln could not do what he did if it had been for John Quincy Adams. I know it because I really have done my work with it. But so sometimes I thought, John Quincy Adams said already in 1820 that we're going to have a sublime war over slavery. 40 years before it happened, he writes that twice in his diary. And he's the one fighting with the Amistad. For the Amistad people and so forth. But so he makes a continental U.S. He's the one who does it and all this kind of stuff. So I've often thought, well, what about if the circumstances were different? Could he have done what Lincoln did? But he was very important in his lifetime, but it was just a different circumstances. And there you had Lincoln. I mean, you had this a very moving description, for example, with Washington, George Washington, after for 5 months the Americans lose. And Washington, this is several of the soldiers describing, they're pretty shocked about George Washington because this big man who's 6 foot something looks over in New York and all the Americans are fleeing and he starts crying, like really weeping. And the people that have written in their diaries and so forth, they were a little freaked out because they said, wow, this is not something for a military commander. Is he really up to his job? And then he made a decision. He found something inside there, and then he stopped crying, and then he went on from there and learned also from what he had done in mistakes and so forth in New York and so on. So some people would give in, put the tail between their legs. And then some people grow from the challenge. You never know. But Lincoln is a good example. I mean, this was a very, very tough situation Lincoln stood in. So it's a... And we have, each of one of us has to prepare that we are able to act on a daily basis, but also then be prepared to do the extraordinarily if that is called upon. We're called upon to do that. So. And she was alive, flesh and blood. She couldn't read and write. Like Harry Tubman, who's called the Joan of Arc of America, she couldn't read and write either. This was a wonderful slave that escaped and then was called the Moses of her people or the Joan of Arc of America because she with the risk of her life every time she went down to the south and took out slaves and she couldn't read and write either. She was only 5 foot tall but she was very tough she's very known to under her skirt, because people would get scared when they were on the boat. They would run at night and then sleep in daytime, and then she would go out and forage for them and see if the road was clear. And sometimes people were scared. They wanted to go back to the slavery. And several times she had a gun in her skirt. You pull it up, you either go with me or you're dead. And they kind of wanted to go with her. But anyway, she was very, very special. She ended up becoming a spy for Lincoln because she knew the South. So, and they could also trust the blackface. You could never trust the whiteface. You didn't know what side they wanted, but you could trust the blackface. Harriet Tubman. She's many names. She's one of my heroines. I really love that lady. What happened is a very special story. We had the trial in Alexandria, putting Lynn in jail, and we had vigils all over America that night when Lynn was going to be put in jail the next day.
And what?
Vigils. That is, throughout the night, we would stand out in parks and whatnot with candles and so on, and then supporters from all the United States would come to where we were. And then on the East Coast of the United States, we had called people like crazy to have them come down to Washington to march for Lynn and for justice. So I was out with a big white farmer in von Steuben Park. Von Steuben was one of the ones that fought in the Revolutionary War in Utica in upstate New York. And it was January, and it was freezing rain. Not just rain, freezing rain, where you know you cannot walk or anything. And we had candles, and we had flowers. I mean, we just wanted to make it nice as possible. And we were interviewed throughout the night, very good interviews. And we had black preachers and white farmers and people coming, visiting us throughout the night. And then we had a bus, a full bus, with mixed black and white people coming to see us in Utica before continuing down to Washington. And we said, wow, that's special, because what we had done, we had just made calls like crazy to the people to go to Washington, but they had to organize it themselves. So the next morning, after Lynn had been put to jail, I say to John, who was an organizer, I want to go to visit that place where this bus came from. And we went and visited that place, because I said, it's a very special place. There's some heritage there. It's a very special place. And it turned out that this was the place where Harriet Tubman lived and worked out from. And there was actually people. It turned out that the guy who runs the Harriet Tubman house is a subscriber of ours. He subscribed to our newspaper in Washington, D.C., where he came from, and now he's running the Harriet Tubman house. So you still had a whole heritage from that time, with the Underground Railroad taking out the slaves from the South and so on. And then now people, I mean, in January to take 10 hours to Washington down and 10 hours back in ice rain, that takes certain commitment, huh? You organize and you pay for everything yourself and so forth. And so when I figured that out, I had to figure out to learn who was Harry Tubman, because I was so excited. Otherwise, I would never have gotten to know, really, because people never talk about her. She has a real fantastic face, too. You know, really special face. She escaped 10 years after Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass talks about her, because Frederick Douglass was very literate and so on and educated. And he describes her as being much better than him, because he was famous and he got all these praise and so forth, but she was the one who worked at night and did all the dangerous stuff. She was so good, this little woman who could not read and write, that in 1840 there was, what was it now? It was either 40,000 or 60,000. It was a huge amount at that time. Money as an award out on her head, dead or alive. Okay. And it was not because she was a good worker. They wanted to get rid of her because she was really good at getting people away from slavery. Yeah. Yes.
Jeanne d'Arc, was that d'Arc? Was that her? The Arc? Was that her family name?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think had happened if he had not?
I don't know. What would have happened if Lincoln had not lived? Right? My God. I mean, Phil would not exist today. My husband.
Hmm.
It's true. Because they would not have fled to the United States from Poland, away from Hitler, and then he would, his father would have been killed, and there would be no film. No, it is really fantastic how individuals causes history, and when it looks absolutely bleak, impossible, when you have had major changes in history. In impossible situations, and that's where it is so good to study history, also for other reasons, but it's one of the reasons. And then you see the actions of individual human beings causes everything to change. Just the whole, it changes the whole geometry. And the question about this, about mobilizing the entire population so that they get remoralized, is of incredible importance, huh? To get people then to act in ways like very similar also, for example, in the Revolutionary War, people were giving in, people were getting discouraged when they lost all these battles, and then when they started, when they had the first victory, when Washington crossed Delaware, thousands of people volunteered. The same in France, then people got remoralized again. And you have to have some people that are the drivers, that even when it looks the most gloomy, the most horrible, that things like Helga when Lynn was in jail, huh? When it looks really bad, that you have to have some people driving it, that to keep people remoralized and fighting. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be you being the driver. I mean, if you want to be really egoistic in a Renaissance way, you go for that. That really
I wish
is
I was egoist.
You want to have a real good, happy life, you make it really rough in that way, to put yourself on the stick every day in that way. As Schiller writes, only the one who dares loses his life wins his life. That's one of the songs from Wallenstein. Sing, oh, love, camarade. I think it's in there. It's kind of a real marching song. But I think it's. Isn't it true that this is in there? That the one who doesn't dare put his life at stake never wins his life? I think so. We can look it up.
Why are people scared?
Huh?
Why are most individuals scared?
Scared of that. What do you think?
Cowardice.
Yeah, but so where does that come from?
From what?
Fear. I often think about it because I think most people have tried it, right? Where you stand in front of something that you have to do. And it's like, and then you do it, and it's like, it wasn't that. It was much more this of looking in front of it, and it's so scary, than to actually doing it. So I often have this image from Dante Alighieri, where he has to go through the wall of fire, like an image. He has to go through the wall of fire, and he's so scared, and oh, and then he does it, and it's like, nothing. Emilia always says that fear is the worst because it grows and grows and grows and grows. But I really think you have to nourish yourself every day to not escape and put challenges on yourself. To continue to develop, take on new challenges, just individual challenges too. And what one thing that is so great about us, I mean, just look in this room, because that is that we are all different, and that means that if we are each of us work very intensely to develop our emotions and our intellect, we will all come out very different. you'll become more and more special and have different qualities, but very special, different people. And that's just like really something.
I think also the Linz, in his webcast, he again and again said this, make it happen.
Yeah.
And because if it's important, do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you stand there thinking about,
mm-hmm.
should I do it? What will happen if I do it? Maybe this, maybe that, and you get terrified by it, and you won't get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have left then is to, you know, sit down and pray for somebody else to do it.
Get drunk,
yeah, run away.
Yeah, I mean, maybe somehow you never try to get drunk, but that's one of the reasons people get drunk. And that's in a really good conversation, right? So, what are you going to say, Hans?
No, I just say that if you don't have a sense of history and you don't have your identity in history, then you will easily, you won't be able to escape this fear in a certain sense, because you have to. You put your identity in something small and silly in a certain sense.
Yeah.
And losing your identity because your identity is in something false, maybe. Is a fear in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now that I read Schiller's Faith.
Yeah.
That
okay.
Is where Jeanne d'Arc falls in love with Emil.
Mm-hmm.
And then she kind of loses her
mm-hmm.
power.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Does it really happen, or is that something that Schiller puts in?
What he writes is really fun to look at it, right? How many of you have read Schiller's drama?
Which one?
Jeanne d'Arc. Do you want to write? Okay. So we shouldn't take all the pleasure away, right? Let's discuss it later on. But I'll say one thing that doesn't change that, and that is that when Schiller writes this drama, he's really, every time he writes a drama, and historical, which most of them are, but he, particularly with the Joan of Arc, he really works on this one, because he wants to make it historically truthful. And he says in some of these letters I read, in the time when he wrote the drama, I read his correspondence to a number of people, and he says, I'm really working on it. I'm really working on making it poetically truthful. Because only when it's poetically truthful will it be historically right. So you can look at the ending, you can look at that. Now you know more of the history. I mean, again, I skipped over a lot of stuff, but because there are certain things I wanted to emphasize. But you have a certain idea now about the historical Joan of Arc. And then you can look at Schiller's and see. And he thought he succeeded extraordinarily with being historically truthful. And people always say, well, in Schiller's drama, he's not burned and all this kind of stuff. So how can that be true? So have fun with it. It's a very... Also look upon it in different layers. Like, remember this when you read it. Remember this thing with the sword and the helmet and the spirit. Because otherwise in the drama that can become mystical. And then look at the drama in three different levels. And then it's a lot of fun. We can discuss that.
But it must also have been a continuing battle, because I think Voltaire... He wrote on Jeanne d'Arc, and he really wrote to destroy her.
But you know,
great passion.
I'm happy you brought it up, because you know John Quincy Adams. He wrote in one of his letters, and he's read about Voltaire's Joan of Arc, and he has one of these letters where he's ready to kill Voltaire because he says that Voltaire is trying to destroy one of the most beautiful souls ever born, namely Joan of Arc. So again, among people knowledgeable, they know. Yeah. Distraction here. So anyway.
Yeah.
Well, except for Hans, you also kept the concentration going.